Robert, I appreciate that, and that's a little intimidating to me. This is not my style. I can't stand podiums, but I can't get everything done at once, so you're going to have to forgive me for this. There's been a change in handouts. I've brought copies because it wasn't in the book, and I've updated this recently. So if you have the black copies, that's not the updated copies, please forgive me. But it says basically the same information. When I was approached to give this talk about the top 10 mistakes, it really wasn't that negatively focused. The focus was going to be on things that you would do differently if you had to do your residency all over again, things that you would make sure that you did, or things that you'd focus on or learn. And so that will be the gist here. And you're going to find some of this isn't meant to be offensive. And if it offends you, I apologize ahead of time. But I've tried to keep it light because it is mistakes, and so it tends to be a little negative. So the objectives, at the end of the session, participants should be able to understand the common oversights that occurred during residency training. This is not going to focus on, gosh, I wish you would have learned how to read EKGs better, or I wish you would have learned acid-base analysis that much better, or I wish you would have learned this complex suturing technique. If that's what you're looking for, John Hunt's just next door, and he's doing complex suturing, but that's not what this is about. This is about some intangibles that we really don't focus on and stress during residency training. They're not really on the model curriculum. You're not going to read it there. You're not going to open up Tip Nally and suddenly read it. It's not going to be in Rosen's text, Harwood Knox. It's not going to be in any of those. So understand that. We're going to take steps to recognize and avoid these oversights in our own training and how we train others. And then hopefully understand that training programs cannot fulfill all of a trainee's needs. Okay, and I think that's, so it's not so much your program's fault, because the program is designed by the RRC to give you a certain section of emergency medicine knowledge and make sure that that's serviceable for you. But in regards to teaching you all there is to learn about emergency medicine, it's just too broad a focus for programs. Okay, and this says, soft shoulders, blind curves, steep grade, big trucks, good luck. And that's somewhat how you feel. You know, everybody's like, gosh, I'm dying to get into my residency program. I'm dying to start my residency program. And as soon as you put your first foot down on the floor, even as an intern, you're suddenly like grabbing your head and saying, what the hell did I get myself into? Right? That's a common feeling for all of us. And the number one maxim here is the coworker or patient that sincerely says to you, I want to get to know you better, is a person you do not want to know at all. Okay? Now, the first topic really is hospital leadership, and what about that do I mean? I say this is the best job, just 16 8-hour shifts, and then my time is my own. This is a graduate's word. That, my translation to that is, my group will be looking for a new contract very soon. Okay? And if you listen to the things that Joe Wood has to say, if you listen to the things that Bob McNamara has to say, and that good sage leadership in emergency medicine, they will teach you the intangibles. One of those intangibles is to inculcate the leadership of whatever hospital that you join and become. Should you do that as a resident? Yes. Should you do that as a student? Yes. That is how you incorporate change. That is how you gain recognition. That is how you gain value to a hospital and to your peers. So how do you infiltrate? What do? You ask to be placed on committees. Now, that's really the opposite of emergency medicine, right? I want to just go work hard at it and get the hell out of there, okay? Now, if you want to maintain that job that allows you some of those freedoms, then you had better become the leadership of that hospital or that institution, or you will be gone, okay? So what do I think of the top committees? Obviously, the executive committee is a strong one to be on, but typically you have to be appointed as a new faculty member to get to that committee, right? So you don't suddenly start a job and get appointed to the executive committee. What are the power committees? And the power committees are really those that will actually get favors owed to you. And so how does that work? Well, if you're the CQI or the risk management committee, right, then all the little nasty scenarios that occur in your hospital are made knowledgeable to you. And you're actually partially responsible for developing a working plan on addressing those problems. People will owe you. You got the picture? The next picture is a credentials committee, which is invaluable. And you think, oh, what a nonsense job. Very valuable job. Because if you're on the credentials committee, then second someone develops a new technology or a new technique, they have to go back to the credentials committee and ask you for approval in order to practice whatever job that is or technique that is or procedure that is. Suddenly you're currying favors right and left. It's absolutely an invaluable committee. Other ones are, you know, just the risk management credentials committee. But you should not be working at a hospital and not be on a committee. That would be foolish. Okay? And the best groups that do it are the groups that split it up and have things divided up. Somebody's on credentials, somebody's on risk management, somebody makes it to the executive committee in that group, right? And that you're well represented in that hospital, that you're not just there to work and get out of there. Because your other peers, your internist, the general surgeon, the subspecialist, none of them have that mentality of I'm going to work a shift and get the hell out of here. And so they resent that. You can do that. So the way to change that attitude is to become part of the leadership of that institution, of that hospital. This investment will pay huge dividends. Now here's a clever thing for students, residents, just about anybody in daily life. Pointedly praising something unusual a staff member owns or has done will make you appear far smarter in the eyes of that individual than a 10-minute dissertation on the pathophysiology of any case. Okay? Billing. Okay? Something that we all abhor, you know, this is not something I want to make my expertise in, but if you talk about things that graduates are not ready to handle and to do, this always comes up. We have a specific month in our residency program that addresses these issues. We have lectures every year that addresses these. When they rotate out to the private institutions, they focus on these as well. And yet my graduates will still come back to me and say, gosh, you know, I really wish you would have addressed billing. And I said, did you attend the lecture? Did you remember this rotation? Do you remember that? Oh, yeah. So I guess you did cover it. Maybe I should say, I wish I had paid more attention when I was doing those things, right? And so I don't need to learn how to bill correctly. The billing company will do that for me. That translation is, I made 40% less than my colleagues last month. Okay? If you change billing services, suddenly it's a fee-for-service gig, and it's your billing that goes in. What you do for billing and how that's checked, then it's going to be based on your documentation and how you bill. Essential component of your training, regardless of the billing company or reimbursement structure. It's linked directly to your documentation. They are not separate. Number three, trying to teach someone a lesson never works. Now, this is incredibly helpful, particularly if you're the emergency medicine physician and you're out in private practice and you want to teach a consultant a lesson. That's never, ever a clever idea. Okay? Because that consultant may be bringing in more business to that hospital than you are. You could be absolutely right, they could be absolutely wrong, and you could be looking for a completely new job. Because they're far more valuable to their institution than you are to your institution. Okay? So your role is not to teach your consultant. That's not your role. Your role is a primary duty to your patients and doing what's best for those patients. And if it means that you have to sugarcoat things for your consultants, then you better learn how to sugarcoat those things. From a documentation standpoint, one of the things, it is ridiculous to include all of that garbage in the chart, that translation. Do you have a name of a good defense attorney? 3 suits in 6 months. Okay? Appropriate documentation reduces successful malpractice litigation. You notice I didn't say it decreases suits. Because you may get sued because of, you know, the glasses that you wear, because of the color of your shoes, because of the afternoon shift that you worked instead of the morning shift. It may have nothing to do with the care that you rendered. Okay? We all take it to heart. We all take it personally when we're litigated again. You're going to have to learn how to get over that because it's going to happen. And it's not going to happen for sensical reasons. It'll be because somebody else yelled to them, they found something else offensive, they waited too long, they were unhappy people to begin with. Okay? But from your standpoint, documentation is essential. It enhances your billing, as we talked about before, and it results in effective communication and patient care. Remember, you want someone to be able to pull your chart aside after the fact and be able to make heads or tails out of it, because what happens if that patient comes in unable to communicate, I don't have any other record, I have that individual chart. I should be able to get valuable information from that chart and from your documentation. And it has to be accurate. Number four, never verbalize any sort of generalization concerning your patients or coworkers, even if it is so true that God would back you up. Okay? The time to make those comments is not in the ED and is not in open settings. Okay? That only causes you to lose. Putting other services down, putting other individuals down, putting other coworkers or team members down in a general audience is never going to work to your benefit. It doesn't empower you. You aren't suddenly elevated in somebody else's eyes. You aren't suddenly revered as a god. It's poor teamwork. And so you want to avoid those things. One of the things, you're all here right now, so as a result, you're actually supporting organized medicine. So that's a heads up. One of the quotes they have, none of those organized medicine groups look out for me. That translation, I'm happy to let other people dictate how I will practice my art. If you don't become engaged in your own medical career and national medical scope, then others will make your decisions for you, whether you like it or not. Okay? You may not believe everything that AAEM says. You may not believe everything that ACEP says. You may not believe anything that another emergency medicine group says. If you do not support those groups, then there will be no effective lobbying done in D.C. You're going to weaken your own stance, whether you're able to hear a voice in the wilderness or not. So it says, organized medicine is the only hope that we have, and it is, because there's too many larger groups with far stronger lobbies that are working against you and what your mission is. Leadership begins at the local level, and then funding for leadership and lobby is essential. And the last thing is at least pay your dues. Okay? For the bare minimum, at least do that. But the message is you have to become engaged. This is an investment in your specialty. As you go through your training, you will discover that more and more of the subjects you have studied are useless, with the exception of abnormal psychology. And then this focuses on teamwork. So that's why they teach you in your silly little nursing school, stick to the bed baths and let me be the doctor. That translation is, so who's your malpractice insurer? I will give you an example. I walk to the bedside, and the nurse alerts me and says, Dr. W, the patient has a heart rate of 130 and a blood pressure of 100 over 50. What would you like to do? Meanwhile, the patient's receiving medication, fluid boluses, and everything else. And I said, you know, I just want to sit tight for right now and look and just see if my bolus works and if everything else. The patient's no longer complaining of chest pain. Let's go ahead and see what happens. Okay. She documents, Dr. W notified, treatment ongoing, patient pain-free. Right? Looks good in the nurse's notes, don't you think? Same thing, same question. Dr. W, what would you like to do? Look, let me do the doctor part. You take care of the nursing part. Got it? Dr. W notified, chooses to do nothing. Okay, it's all about the team. And if you want to make sure that you're litigated successfully, you alienate team members. Okay? Believe me, and then word gets out very quickly. Okay? And I'm not telling you that you have to bring them food, you have to kiss their feet, you just have to be a good team member. Because emergency medicine, unlike other specialties, okay, is very, very team-oriented. You will conduct the care of anywhere between 1 and 20 patients with as many as 2 22 to 30 healthcare providers at one time. So you've got to be the juggler. And if you're alienating people with what comes out of your mouth, then your team function is going to go down in flames. And as a result, your patient care choices, although they may be very clever, may not ever be carried out. And so, there is no I in team, obviously. Remember, everybody can hurt you, and they will. The respiratory therapist will. The pharmacist will. The nurse aide will do it every time. Orderly will. Transport, x-ray tech. You just won't see the film that has a fracture. They'll do that to make a point. So understand that. Treat other care providers with the same respect as your physician colleagues. Okay? And it helps to keep a positive attitude. Never wear that pair of floral print scrubs. While you might think you're expressing your individuality, your colleagues will perceive this as a rejection of their group culture. Your trust will be suspect. Okay? It doesn't mean that you can't be an individual. But if you're bringing attention to yourself with outlandish things, then people are going to think that maybe you're less trustworthy than you should be. Doesn't mean that you should be a Stepford wife. It doesn't mean that you should be a clone. But you shouldn't be that far out on the bell curve. Now, emergency medicine attracts that type of individual. Trust me, I know that. Okay? I get to see that on a daily basis. However, if you exert your individuality in multitudes of ways, you're going to tend to alienate more people than garner their trust. So just be wary of that. Disability insurance. I don't need to waste my money on disability insurance during my training. That is money better spent on beer. Translated. Hepatitis C and my liver enzymes are elevated, I am screwed. Okay? If I can tell you the number of times that our residents have said, oh yeah, this disability thing, this is important, it's important, but I've got so many other things that I need to make sure I'm covered. If the residency program or when you get out, if you're not looking for disability insurance as your number one thing as you leave, you're in big trouble. This is something that you should have during residency training. For these reasons alone. I mean, people talk about HIV. I'm deathly afraid for my residents in hepatitis C. Far more easily transmissible. We can do a hell of a lot less for it than we can for HIV. So just be understanding of that. And you're at profound risk due to needle sticks, your training, teaching other people, your enclosed confines. Your patients are not unconscious majority of the time. Right? So you're at great risk. The EM field is a high-risk field, and it's not changing. Your risk for needle stick is increased during training, and chances are you're engaged in high-risk behavior. Okay? That's what we do. If you go to get disability insurance, being an emergency medicine physician places you in a high-risk group from the get-go. So you need to be aware of that. You're in a high-risk group for a reason. Bad things happen to you. Okay? And it happens to you due to your work, and it happens to you due to the things you do away from work. So you need to be conscious of that. So how can you plan for a disability? I mean, it's not like it's going to happen to you. You can't be so sure, right? It can happen to any of us. So number 7. It is more important to have good health insurance than good health. Okay? And, travesties, we don't plan. But guess what? Residents are the perfect age for feeling absolutely invincible. Bulletproof. I get to see it. These are the individuals who, I don't wear my seatbelt. I mean, one of my graduates from a combined program, one of the most brilliant people that I know, rides his motorcycle without a helmet. So he's a donor waiting to happen. Okay? That's what's going on. Go figure. Right? But we all think that illness and travesty and life can't touch us, that we're in our bulletproof phases. We're not. We're all vulnerable. Next issue is moonlighting. It's a quiet place, guaranteed, no major hits. That translation? There's a 1-week-old in status epilepticus, and here comes a 45-year-old delivering twins. Okay? Oftentimes, the things that I get to hear from my residents are, the financial constraints of residency training. They are tremendous. They are considerable, and debt accruement is a consideration. The other thing I hear is, residency training really doesn't prepare me for practice. Okay? I hear those things. But also, you need to know the other issues. If you believe strongly that your patients are why you do medicine, and your duty is to your patients, then you're selling them short if you think a moonlighting experience is a benefit to your patient. Future income versus immediate income, there's a lot of debate about that, and debt accruement. Does it undermine the specialty? Absolutely, it undermines the specialty of emergency medicine. It does. No way around it. And then the other issue is, I've got a resident who we fought very hard for to go ahead and work 17 to 16 12-hour shifts, and they'll go ahead and set up 7 shifts of moonlighting to augment that. Now, the reason I fought to get them so low in their numbers for hours is so that they could have more wellness pursuits. I don't consider moonlighting a wellness pursuit. Number 8, coming to work late in the same clothes you left work in is not considered a sign of success, right? We've seen those guys struggle in. Now, malpractice issues. I have signed a fat contract with a great group practicing insane elsewhere, and it's going to be sweet. Translation, I'm going to be set up like a sitting duck for litigation attorneys. Okay, the highest paying job is rarely, if ever, your best job. Right? That higher income is there for a reason. Hello? Okay? People aren't just saying, gosh, you're so nice. We're going to pay you top dollar. That's not what they're looking for. The translation is, we're going to see more patients. These are going to be sicker patients. You're going to work crazier hours. And you're going to be absolutely stressed out. Now, you got that for $10 more per hour? I mean, that just doesn't make sense. When I talk to my graduates who get out, they say, yeah, you know, I worked at that fast place job because they really paid a whole bunch of money, and, you know, I left them after 2 years, and now I'm settled down, and I know what I want, and I'm no longer working 20 shifts. I'm working 14-8. And gosh, I wish I would have known that when I got out. Yeah, we wish you would have known that when you got out, too. But, you know, there tends to be, because of accruing debt, because of everything else, there tends to be this reach for this dollar, thinking that the dollar job is a status thing and thinking that it's a better job. And oftentimes, that dollar job, not oftentimes, the majority of times, that top dollar job is not your best job. It's top dollar for a reason. There's either more hoops or more problems or more concerns or more stress. So be wary of the top paying job. Doesn't mean don't take it. You just better make sure you're taking it for the right reasons. And that right reason is at $15 to $20 more per hour for that particular job. Number 9, citing the TV show ER as a basis for your treatment decisions will not guarantee you a passing oral board score. Okay? So that's not going to count. It's not going to help you on the National In-Service next week either. And then finances. I bought my convertible Beamer, jet ski, and a new home entertainment center after my first paycheck. Translation. Do you know of any good financial advisors that do debt consolidation? Okay? Financial planners will tell you when you are moving up in a class, a financial class, as in when residents move from residency training to their jobs, they advocate that for the first 6 months, you live at the same identical fashion that you just were for the last year. They don't tell you, this is not the time to make the purchase of the house. This is not the time to make the purchase for the car. This is not the time to start eating sushi 24 hours a day at the most expensive, eclectic place in town. Okay? Not the time for that. All right? Physicians don't have clever financial sense. Okay? They just don't. All right? So this is a wise time to invest in somebody who does. Okay? I was very fortunate. I married a banker. Okay? I would just say that, you know, your financial decisions are essential decisions. You know, I have one of my residents who was very clever and made a mint in the market when the market was fat during residency training. Made a mint. Made a lot of the faculty money as well, a lot of his friends' money as well, lost a lot of money as well. Okay? But I would be cautious with that. Okay? Very cautious. If it's not an area of expertise, Get somebody who is an expert in that area, somebody who is trustworthy. Okay? There's lots of people. You don't understand this, and it's hard to imagine, but bankers fight over residents in training because this is a big ticket that's going to happen. Bankers would love to be your personal banker, but you can actually walk that out there and talk to people. They would love to get your name, number, and help you out, loan you money. They'd love to do that. As a physician, you are a safe bet. As an emergency medicine physician, you're a very safe bet. You've got great job security. Okay? So they're willing to invest in you. You need to be cautious with that. Make sure you get trustworthy, good people. Number 10, always imply in every possible way that the person you are talking to is smarter, better looking, slimmer, and more successful than they really are. Lifelong learning. Some of you who attended the major meeting at lunch got to hear ABEM in their presentation. Okay? And I know what your senses are, you know, National In-Service is coming up and everything, but this is the last test that I will ever have to take, and I will never crack another book. Right? That translation, welcome to the recertification process. All right? The way that you're going to learn is lifelong learning. And that's it. So if you haven't developed skills during residency training to teach yourself as you go new material, you're going to suffer in your initial 2-3 years out. Because after you're not being detailed, after you're not going to residency conference and made to go, right, it's going to be all your own CME way to do things. Whether you're going to get it via mail, whether you're going to attend conferences, whatever it's going to be, it needs to be organized and it needs to be set up. And you have to have a plan for that, actually, before you leave the residency program. Because ideally, what are the stressors that you go through? Well, I'm graduating. It's a stressor. Hit the stressor level. The majority of you move. Stressor level. The majority of you start a new job. Another major stressor. And then, funny enough, within the first 6 months, we expect you to take your board certifying exam. So while you're starting a new job, moving, transitioning, feeling all for yourself, we expect you to sit down, study, and burn it for that written exam. And then turn right around and take your oral board in 6 months from then. Okay? That's a lot to juggle. So actually, even after that, the new certification process is going to have you on a pathway of lifelong learning. You're going to have to read these articles. You're going to have to take these tests to recertify. And that recertify is not going to be as it used to be. Once every 10 years, you sit for an exam. You're going to have to take quizzes as you go, learning as it goes. Because nobody's going to be detailing you. Nobody's going to cause you to force feed you new information that's going to impact your patients and healthcare decisions. So you're going to have to come up with a plan to do that on your own. And a plan. It doesn't happen to you. It's not residency program. Everybody's going to sit you in a chair and make sure you attend it. You have to do that on your own. It establishes learning habits that will last, incorporates learning into your practice. One of the things that we do in our own residency program is one of the daily checkoff forms is evidence-based medicine practice. So they're actually encouraged to go to the bedside, make an evidence-based medicine decision, validate it on the computer, and then discuss it with the attending, with the other resident, and the other officers, so that they get into a habit, right? So that when you're out in practice and you're working and you're saying, okay, I've got Bell's palsy here, let me just do a quick check and say whether acyclovir is the way to go or steroids is the way to go, which one, let me see what I should do and why I should do that. Right? So that you can teach yourself and stay current as you go and access those resources. And those resources are going to involve computers. Let's see. Recertification process will help meet this end and embrace new technology and tools, whether that be the Palm tools or whether it be laptops, whether it be internet, whether the new technology is going to be the craze. Ultrasound isn't just here as a flash. It's going to stay. In fact, it's going to progress. 5 years from now, where ultrasound is with FAST is where we'll be with echocardiography. Okay? So embracing technology is only going to benefit you. Number 11, telling your faculty that you are a free spirit means you are a total liability. Okay? So be cautious with that. So wellness issues. After I get out, I'll start working out again and stop eating fast food. I mean, the number of times that I get to hear this at end-of-the-year reviews with the residents is astounding. The translation for that, after I retire, I'll start working out again and stop eating fast food. Okay? So the choices that you need to make are essential. Your spiritual fitness, your mental fitness, and physical fitness are not separate. They're all linked. That's all part of it. Okay? And we take substantial hits during training. And then we are under this false illusion that suddenly it's going to be dramatically different. That once I get out, I'm going to have all the time in the world. And when I get out, it's going to be much better. So I'll be making a lot more money. And when I get out, I'll be able to take trips and do this. And you know, some of the cases that happens. But some of the cases, if you were dogged in residency training and not good to yourself then, it doesn't suddenly change when you get out. It's not what happens. You need to tune in to the things that make you healthy, the things that give you pleasure, the things that recharge your batteries. If you don't, you're going to have a trouble. It's going to struggle, and you're going to carry on the same way. You know, I get to hear it from my residents who are out, who talk to the residents who are leaving now. I said, look, you know, I thought I had to work extra so I could make up this debt and do this, and then I found out that I didn't know who my significant other was. We wound up splitting. I paid for a house that I have to now share with somebody else, so we sold it, and all these other things tend to fall apart because you're not putting the priorities where they should be. Remember, the healthier you are, the healthier your work's going to be. High-risk jobs such as yours require effective wellness pursuits. You have to have a plan. Wellness doesn't just happen to you, okay? This doesn't descend upon you and say, now you're well. You have to, like you have a financial plan, like you have a lifelong learning plan, you actually have to plan for wellness. Okay, and wellness pursuits need to be, this is my talk that all my residents get, they need to be cheap, they need to be reproducible, easily accessible, and not dependent on somebody else. So there can't be a financial barrier. I had a resident who said, yeah, my international travel is my wellness pursuit. Right, once a year, okay? Or, you know, I really like skydiving. It's great, but you know, how often are you able to do that? What's the cost involved with this? Things that you can do by yourself that are not, you know, I like to do something with my significant other, but, you know, I'm working nights and so I can't do it because they're not there. That's not a great wellness pursuit. You're making it dependent on somebody else for your own wellness. Once again, it needs to be cheap, easily reproducible, easily accessible, right, and not dependent on somebody else. Be aware that the majority of your patients and co-workers are operating on a very condensed version of the Ten Commandments, the part about murder. Okay? Enjoy the New Orleans cuisine. Thank you very much.
That's a great. Dr. Ray is a senior emergency medicine resident at Wright State University College.